Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
From Postcard from the Past and Wardour Studios, this is Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. This is the podcast where we consider unnaturally blue skies, car parks in front of cathedrals, and grinning, oversized good luck cats, as we discover the picture postcards brought in by my guests, and together we explore what it was that caused them to keep hold of these little ephemeral cardboard oblongs. As I say, each time I welcome two guests, and it's their postcards that act as tiny prompts to send us rushing towards memories, mysteries, and stories. I'm Tom Jackson, and I'm delighted to say that today my guests are children's author Jonathan Mears and artist Liza Adamczewski. Jonathan and Liza, welcome to Podcast from the Past.
Hello.
Thank you, Tom. Hello.
Now, Jonathan Mears might first have impressed himself upon your consciousness as a Perrier Award-nominated stand-up comedian. As an actor, he's appeared on radio and TV and in various films. But these days, he is definitely best known for being an author, the author of over 30 children's books, particularly his best-selling, award-winning series, The World of Norm. Now, Jonathan joins us today bearing a NG2 postmark. What's that, Jonathan?
What's that, Tom? Oh, I'll tell you what that is. It's a long way from where I'm speaking to you at the moment, but it is my spiritual home. NG2 is the post code of the city ground, home of the mighty Reds, aka Nottingham Forest Football Club. Suburb of Nottingham, actually, just across Trent Bridge from Nottingham itself, in a suburb called West Bridgeford. Yes, it's the postmark of my beloved. I'm one of these weird people that support the football team from their local football team, and have never changed.
it used to be the rule.
So it's the city ground, Nottingham, NG2. Yes.
And you used to go a lot, did you, when you were a kid? Or
I did. It's over 50 years since I made my debut on the terraces as a young whippersnapper. And it's still to this date, I think, the worst match I've ever been to. Forest nil, Burnley nil on a Tuesday night. But I saw the second match I ever went to. I was dragged there by my mum. And it was a nighttime match. And it was versus West Ham. It was only a couple of years after the World Cup final. So there's Bobby Moore and Jeff Hurst and Martin Peters. But I was there for the glory days, the late 70s, the Clough era, the European Cup winning team. And City Ground, oh, mist rolling. Tells you exactly when it was, because the cry then, and still now, Mull of Kintyre was in the charts whenever that was. 79.
Something
and the
like
cry
that.
Used to go, if you'll excuse my excruciating voice, I wasn't expecting to do it, in a sort of Nottingham accent, City Ground, oh, mist rolling in from the Trent, my desire. I know. It doesn't have quite the same ring to it, but I was there for the glory years. Yeah. And I've been through thick and thin, mainly thin ever since, I have to say.
I can hear it now under the floodlights in a midweek fixture. Fantastic. Atmospheric. Important question. Jonathan, do you still send postcards?
One word, no. I've been trying to think when the last time. Well, I could just say yes. But no, I'm going to be honest. Honesty.
I admire your honesty.
Yeah. No, I was in the Merchant Navy back in the day, and they were a lifeline for me then. Virtually the only way of, well, the postcards and the sort of airmail, aerogram blue sort of light airmail letter things. I phoned my parents once. I joined the Merchant Navy, and I went, my first trip to sea was to New Zealand. I was away for 6 months, and I got to speak
Oh,
to my parents
wow.
once. I got to speak to my parents once on the telephone. It cost a fortune from the Siemens mission in Wellington in New Zealand. So no, I hope I'm sort of balancing this out. I don't send them anymore, although I am a lover of postcards and I collect postcards. But I more than made up for that when I was a youngster in the Merchant Navy.
Very good. Now, let's talk about you, Lisa. Lisa Adamczewski trained at the Royal College of Art. Mm-hmm. She's had a career spanning both the commercial and the fine art worlds. But recently, she's been creating a distinctive art project called #1000postcards, which is a real-life project where she's painting postcards with images from nature, but it's also displayed on Twitter, so it's a sort of digital project as well. And she describes these as little messages from nature that will build up into a complete artwork. Now, we're going to be talking a bit more about 1000postcards later on, I'm hoping. Now, Lisa, you come today to us with a GU28 postmark. What's that?
Do I just? That's the Wool House in sort of near Midhurst in Sussex, which is...
Sounds nice.
It was when we had it as a escape from city life when I was a child, and it had never been touched. So it was an ancient house. It appears in the Domesday Book, and it had been won in a game of cards.
No.
Yeah, as has the house that I live in now.
You're joking.
Nope. I tend to buy houses that have changed hands in games of poker.
This must limit your options when you go to the estate agent.
It's fine. I'm never moving again. So, you know, I'm here and I'm putting my roots down. But, yeah, the Wool House was a phenomenal place. It had no indoor bathroom, a barn full of carts with the, you know, like you see on Western movies with the cars over them, and
the wagons,
gypsy caravan, and a swamp, and all the things that you want when you're a child.
This sounds like a dream for kids.
It was phenomenal. You know, you never had to have a bath. You got kind of wiped down with an oily rag, or washed in the kitchen sink, and there was a pump for the water, a hand pump. No heating, just open fires and.
Really?
Yeah, just strange things. Like I had a dressing up box full of crinolines and feather boas. It was amazing. Like even the next door neighbour had a dog that bit my worst enemy's ear off. Which was great.
You're living next door to Vincent van Gogh.
We lived in a place called Camberwell Grove in South London.
Oh, yes.
And
very
then
nice.
My parents rented this house. They had a sitting tenancy on it. For weekends and holidays. So it was like a second home, I guess, in the
Perfect.
Days when people didn't think of them as second home. It was our country place and our town place.
Very good.
It was very nice. It was too. Very
Excellent. And that, I guess that would have fired up a bit of interest in countryside stuff for you. Is that right? Or?
That's very much what it, where everything to do with my passion for nature started there. I was a very solitary child. Had elder brothers who had their own treehouse, and as I tottered up to it, they would pull up the rope ladder so that I couldn't join in.
Nice.
And they were Chelsea supporters, you know. And,
oh, dear.
Yeah, exactly. Not my cup of tea.
So the key question, Lisa, when did you last send a postcard?
Well, I send postcards all the time.
Excellent. Listen to this, Jonathan, and learn.
I know.
And I make
Sorry.
Them. I don't just mean I send postcards on Twitter for my art project, but I'm sending a postcard today. But I cheat because I put my postcards in an envelope so they don't get stolen, because I make my postcards and they often have things stuck to them and, you know, bits of jewellery that I've made out of recycled tomato paste tubes and little paintings, and they can be on canvas boards or things like that. So,
right.
You know, I would, in the past, I used to send them whole without an envelope because I love the thing of the franking marks that you get, you know, the post stamps and the actual stamps and all that kind of stuff. But nowadays, too much stuff gets nicked in the post, I'm afraid. So I now put them in envelopes. I mean, the whole idea of the project was that I wanted to see, when I bought this place, we've got like 57 acres of land, and I wanted to see whether we had over 1,000 species on it, which of course there is, but I wasn't sure how barren the place might be. And so I thought, well, if I paint a postcard every day of something new and then I tweet it on Twitter, gradually this will build up and I can show people what biodiversity actually means, because you'll be able to walk into a room and see 1,000 things that could perhaps be in a quarter of a square acre.
How far into the project are you at the moment? What number are you up to? And when you get to 1,000, do you think you may be tempted to carry on? There'll be like a huge
vacuum
in your life.
You'll definitely carry on beyond. I'll always carry on, because I'll always be finding new things, I hope.
So where are we now? What number are we up to now?
Well, not being male, I haven't been really obsessing about the numbers, so I actually haven't counted.
Unbelievable.
Roughly about 700.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
Yeah. And my long-suffering husband has been making display cabinets for them, like museum cabinets of
shelves.
Actually,
I've seen pictures of these. They're very attractive. They sit really well in there.
Yeah, and so the whole thing becomes like this artwork where you see all these different species and... like you would in a museum when things are extinct. So it's about showing you what biodiversity can be, and that if we don't look after it, one day you might only see it in a museum. So my all my work's kind of ecologically based, and it's always very beautiful, I hope, to draw people in. But sometimes the message behind it's really quite sad. Mm-hmm. But because people find it really attractive and they get drawn to it, they then can't avoid the message behind it.
Brilliant.
It kind of gets it across better than doing some kind of grim, shouty painting, if you know what I mean.
Right. Well, look, we're going to be looking at some of Lisa's cards in a minute and actually talk a bit more about the art, how the artwork works. But it's been a good introduction to it. And we'll see some of Jonathan's cards as well. But I'll give you a quick one of mine. This is like a postcard from the past card, like I do on Twitter. So it's an old card from which I've just taken a little bit of the message. So the first card I've got here, it's what we call a multi-view. So there's lots, four images of the Dorset coast. In this case, they're three images sort of radiating from a round swan's nest at Abbotsbury. And I suppose it's meant to be a little... It's meant to imply sunshine, I think. And it's the Dorset...
Oh, yes.
Do you see? It's sort of like a Art Deco kind of sunburst.
Oh, I see that now.
Sunburst design.
Yeah. So, no, you got Lyme Regis, West Bay, Chesil Beach, Abbotsbury. Anyway, the message that attracted me is... I think it's from a child, this. There's no date on it. It was, in fact, it's been sent in an envelope. I don't know if it's because they thought it was quicker or because it was precious, like yours, Lisa. I'm not sure. Anyway, this is... chap called Marco sending it to his friend Richard, and in fact he says, Richard, sorry, I don't know your address, Phil, can you please pass it on to Richard? So it already has a bit of a journey before we get to the message. And the bit of the message was, he was saying, there are lots of quarries here and fossils can be found, which is true in that part of the world. It says, so far, my brother and I have found 39.5p and one silver spoon on our metal detector.
Oh,
fantastic.
So
39.5p.
Brilliant.
I thought you could, so obviously it's after 1970 for decimalisation, but I thought, well, you couldn't make up that detail of what they found. So very sweet. Well, I should remind those of you listening to the podcast that images of all the cards we discussed today, they're on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk, so you can see we're not making any of this up. Now, Jonathan and Lisa, you've been kind enough to dig out, especially for this long-distance remote recording, some postcards of your own. So, Lisa, let's start with you. The first card you've got for us is... Is it a Samuel Palmer? Have I got that right?
It is, yes. It's a Samuel Palmer. And if I'd done my art history, I'd actually know the title of it. But I've slept since then. It was a long time ago.
I think I can see it on the back. I think it's in a Shoreham garden.
That's right, yeah. It's a beautiful, what I've it's always lovely. Imagined to be an apple tree heavy with blossom, which is really lovely. And it was sent to me by a very special person. You know, like they say, in everybody's life, there's one teacher who makes the difference.
Yeah.
Yes, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky. And I was a really disturbed, damaged child. I left school at 15 with two O-levels and used to do things like ring the school up and tell them there was a bomb on the premises and things like that. I was really bad because I was dyslexic and nobody knew about dyslexia. And I used to get caned a lot, which was another reason why I didn't like going to school. So hadn't had a great time at school. And I went to art school. I got in on my portfolio when I was 17. And when I stayed on to do my degree, I had this tutor called John Lawrence. And it was a revelation to me that someone who taught you could be so kind and supportive. And I used to watch him go around the studio. And it didn't matter how dreadful someone's artwork was, he would always find something in it.
Brilliant.
To draw them out and to encourage them and to keep them going. And he was an amazing teacher. And he taught me how to do wood engraving. That was his speciality. And if you look at his work up, I mean, he's an incredibly successful illustrator. And I think he might even just still be alive. He was living in Cambridge when he sent me this card. And he was just lovely. He really inspired me in so many ways. And I ended up going on to teach at the same college as him one day a week. And he really...
This was at Camberwell, was it?
Yeah, at Camberwell. And he influenced me not only in the way I worked, because I got most of my jobs as a wood engraver to start off with, but also he influenced me in the way I taught. He was just this amazing man, and he was very kind and gentle. And then after I'd finished college, he sent me this card. You know, he didn't stop caring for me or looking after me as a tutor, even when his job was over. It was really charming. And I think that's why I kept the card, because he was kind. And that was quite a new experience in my life. You know, I have to say, my family was quite difficult. You know, they're very interesting parents, but you know, quite damaged by the war. And they were not particularly kind. And this gentleman was really, really kind. And I think he taught me that that's one of the most important things that a person can be, is gentle and kind. But if I hadn't had him as a tutor, I don't think I would have necessarily stayed doing what I did stay doing for the rest of my life.
Really? So he was that influential?
He was that influential. And I have got rid of it. You know, I'm not a great hoarder of things. It was a real struggle to find these things because, of course, we moved 4 years ago and a lot of stuff is in boxes. And I don't have a big box of postcards. I had four postcards that I'd saved and they were all from this period of my life. And two of them were from fellow art students, sort of gay male friends of mine. And they were so rude. I really wanted to put them.
Oh, rude meaning outrageously rude.
Outrageously rude, you know, from that pre-AIDS period. And I thought, no, I can't really...
Do you mean the messages were rude, Lisa, or the actual images? Oh, the messages were...
The messages were just really naughty, a bit in a carry-on comedy sort of a way. But they were very funny cards, you know, and I looked at them and I thought, but there isn't, you know, you'd said it needs to be a card that's got a story to it. And I thought, well, there is a kind of story to it, but it's a very personal, private story to do with other people. And I'm not sure if I can really talk about that publicly. But these cards I can talk about publicly. So that was one of the reasons that I chose them, because the others were so indiscreet, I didn't dare. Yeah. So he was just lovely. I really loved him like a kind of uncle. He was just... And that was the other thing about him as well, because a lot of the male staff at art school in the 70s were very predatory. And he wasn't. He wasn't predatory. He was a happily married, old-fashionedy sort of bloke. And he wasn't at all predatory. And so you felt very safe with him. And it was, you know, it was really... He was lovely. He was truly, truly lovely. And I only hope he listens to your podcast and realises how much of an effect. And I'm sure it wasn't just me that felt like that about him. Everybody liked this guy. And his character comes over in his work. Anyway, he was a great lover of Samuel Palmer and William Blake. And we used to bond quite a lot over that. And he opened up the library to me as a dyslexic. He showed me how to use the library. to such an extent that at a later date, I went into a secondhand bookshop and I actually bought the bookshop and ended up running a running a bookshop for about seven years. Yeah, which took me away from my art for a bit. But it was great. I used to do book search for people and I'd say, yes, I can find it for you as long as you spell it for me.
Gosh, where was
where was the bookshop?
It was in a village called Yoxford in Suffolk.
Wow.
Don't tell me you've been there. No, near Southwold and Aldborough. There's a place on the corner called Satis House.
Satis House, yes. Used to be a very good restaurant in there.
There certainly was, because the lady that ran it was Malaysian.
Yes,
and the reason
right.
I know that place so well is that I'll come to this a little bit later, actually. But when my wife and I, that's the that we were, my then girlfriend and myself were having a weekend at Satis House. And yeah. that's the weekend when we decided to get married. We didn't get married that weekend. But that's when we actually decided to get married.
I lived in Suffolk for 25 years. I ran away from London.
Beautiful part of the world.
And I bought a Coast Guard cottage, which actually, I have to admit, wasn't one in a game of cards.
I'm slipping there.
But it was a Coast Guard cottage in between Aldborough and Southwold. And it was amazing. I lived there until we moved here.
But it's a beautiful story, that the fact that you, a self-confessed dyslexic, ended up buying and running a bookshop. There's a novel in there. If I wrote that kind of stuff, a short story or a novel or a film in there, it's a beautiful
story. Well, I taught myself to spell. It was great. I bought myself a computer and I taught myself how to use it. And I bought the bookshop just as everything went online to sell books. Which was great, because the bookshop, which was, this is no joke, it was, the front of it was made out of a Georgian four-poster bed that had been taken apart.
Good Lord.
And so an antiques dealer friend of mine said, if you dismantled that and put it back together and sold it as a restored bed, which legally you're allowed to do, it'd be worth more than your business.
Wow.
Which is really funny. I used to pay £350 a year rent.
Good Lord.
For this shop, and I've paid a few £1,000 for the lease. It was, you know, you couldn't fail, basically, because the overheads were like peppercorn.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's quite bookish around there as well.
There's a lot of bookish people. Lots of people retire from Cambridge to that area and London as well. And it was fantastic. I just sat there cataloguing books and reading, and I got it was like a 7-year education where I just read my way through this bookshop, and it was brilliant. It was, yeah, I met some really, I mean, I had great customers there, but the guy would come in and he'd want a 50 pence cowboy paperback, and I had Prince Charles's Librarian. I mean, the cross section of people was fascinating, and I made some great friends. It was a really lovely time, and I could take my dog to work with me every day. And when it got really boring, I would just close the shop and go and have a walk on the beach at Dunwich and put a sign on.
Dunwich.
It was just lovely, you know, it was ideal.
Freedom.
Really.
You were saying about 50p cowboy books, and that's just made me think of, there was a series of books by this guy called J.T. Edson. Does that name ring any bells?
Rings a bell, I think, yes.
Yeah, I'm no authority on
those sort of books.
But there was this, I went to school in Melton Mowbray in Leicestershire.
Pork pie country.
Yeah, pork pie country and hunting country, obviously. And J.T. Edson was apparently a very, very successful, what do you call it, Pulp fiction. Thank you. Sort of like pulp cowboy fiction, if that's a genre.
Yeah.
But J.T. Edson, I don't think that was his real name, he just used to absolutely churn these books out and was very, very in that kind of niche field of pulp cowboy fiction. But apparently there'll be listeners that will be nodding their heads sagely,
yep.
I'm sure.
There are people that collect kind of things avidly.
And he lived in Melton Mowbray.
You're joking.
Could regularly be seen wandering around Melton Mowbray in his...
I thought you were going to say could regularly be seen riding into town with a Stetson on.
Yeah, eating a pork pie. With his chaps and his six gun and his cowboy
Spurs.
Hat. He was a character, a bit of a character.
Was he American or English?
No, he was from Leicestershire. I never engaged him in conversation. I didn't.
You wouldn't want to.
No, he shot me. It was a different time. It was the 70s. He shot me. It would have been pork pies at dawn. I never did engage him in conversation. But I believe I'm going to look him up on the internet. I'm going to stick my neck out and say he was Melton born and bred, because why else?
Amazing.
Why else would he be living in Melton Mowbray, for goodness sake?
Yeah, maybe on the run.
Yeah.
Amazing. Exactly. Well, I'm not quite sure how your card took us to all these places, Lisa, but we're going to move on to the next one now. So, yeah. Jonathan, what's the first card landing on your doormat?
Ah, well, Tom, funny you should say that, because they say every picture tells a story. And in this particular I now know to call this a multi-view postcard.
Excellent.
This is Mora.
Mora.
Mora, a tiny village on the west coast of Scotland on the road to the Isles, nearly at the very end. Another 2 or 3 miles beyond Mora, and you get to the fishing port of Malig. And that is Malig, not Malaig. As most people south of the border, and actually many people up here in Scotland pronounce it Malay. It is Malig.
Malig.
I'm no pronunciation Nazi, but having spent the last, I don't know, 35 years visiting that part of the world, I have it on very good authority that the locals pronounce it Malig. One of those locals being my wife, who I met in London in 1985. She wasn't my wife then, obviously. That would have been weird. But we met in September 1985 in the canteen at Bush House, BBC World Service Bush House. My wife is working for the African Service, World Service, the BBC at the time. I was doing stand-up. My brother worked in the BBC. We met. It was love at first sight. Blah, 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 blah. And so we met in the September. And that Christmas, I was invited up to the family home up in Mora for the first time. Now we've already ascertained I was in the Merchant Navy when I was from 16 to 22. I sailed around the world, so I was no stranger to the concept of long journeys. But this particular journey was something else. It felt like I was like traveling on the Trans-Siberian Express or something. I'd never been up to that part of the world at all, let alone by train before. And it wasn't helped by the fact that it just took forever. And it didn't help by the fact that I had to change trains in Glasgow. And the train from Glasgow to Fort William broke down literally just outside Queen Street Station in Glasgow. And subsequently, this is just before Christmas 1985, and subsequently, the train was very, very delayed. So delayed, in fact, that the connection from Fort William to Malig didn't hang around. We missed it. And so this was my first ever time. It was a huge thing for me to be going up, seeing my girlfriend in her home and meeting her family, meeting her large family. And so we missed the connection in Fort William. And subsequently, we were those of us that were going beyond Fort William on the West Highland Line, as it's known. We were bundled into this tiny, cramped little minibus, and the road from Fort William to Malig has improved considerably since those days. In those days, it's extremely twisty, extremely narrow road. So much so that we'd scarcely left Fort William, and there was a kid sitting in just in front of me, and the kid had vomited everywhere. And so on top of this, it'd already been just an epic journey all the way from London up to Fort William. There was this horrendous smell of vomit in this tiny, sweaty petrol.
You're selling it to me.
I know. So we have, and I thought we were never going to get there. I mean, it's still in those days. I mean, you can do it in about 45 minutes now from Fort William to Malig, because the road has improved so much. But in those days, it was about an hour and a half, going little detours, dropping people off at all the little stations along the way where they were supposed to be getting off. We eventually arrived in Malig, and I got sort of bundled, just got kicked out the minibus. And my wife comes up to me, it's pitch black, and she's got this enormous shiner of a black eye.
Oh.
Having been accidentally headbutted by an over enthusiastic local at the local Cayley. You know, it was like, you know, the way they're sort of stripping the willow and throwing each other around. It's just a bit of local fun. So having had this journey from hell, this vomit, you know, And there's my beautiful girlfriend with this huge shiner. So talking about sort of being headbutted at Kayleigh's, if we move to the clockwise, so top right hand image, that's Mora Bay, where the River Mora comes out into the bay and goes off beyond. Is Mallig and Mora is basically, if you imagine the southern tip of Skye, it's kind of level with that. You can all look it up on your maps afterwards. But if you come out of the bay there, where the boats, I mean, it's obviously low tide there, but you squiggle around the river, it's only visible at low tide, hang a left at the bay, and you come to the most sensational beach called Camasdarach Beach. I don't want to go on about it too much because I don't want it to become too popular, but it always comes rates very highly in these most beautiful beaches in the world thing. But it's the scene of many, many happy times for myself and my girlfriend, my wife and my boys. It's a beautiful sand dune. It is the most sensational beach. It's one of those when people go on and on and on about the weather up here. I mean, seriously, when you get a gorgeous day in that neck of the woods, you wouldn't want to be anywhere else. And seriously, you could be forget when you're seeing the Coolins of Skye and right opposite the Isle of Rum and everything. And on a beautiful summer's day, it's not quite as warm, but you could be mistaken for thinking that you're in like a Montserrat or somewhere in the Caribbean. It's absolutely sensational. But Camasdarach Beach, talking about Kayleigh's in my long sort of round the houses kind of way. Movie fans amongst you familiar with the movie Local Hero?
Of course.
And that the Bill Forsyth movie. Well, the beach scenes are actually filmed on Camasdarach Beach, where the hut on the beach and yes. Burt Lancaster's there and everything. So now we go down to the bottom right, and you will see a church on the banks of Loch Mora. It's the deepest freshwater loch in Britain. It's a depth of about 1,000 feet in the middle of the loch. Home of the much cooler and much more famous Morag, the monster. But also this church is called St. Cumin's Church, or to give it its proper Catholic title, Our Lady of Perpetual... They know how to name a church. Our Lady of Perpetual Succor and St. Cumin's. And that is the very church where my girlfriend and I got married.
That's really soppy. That's great.
Yeah,
I know.
Your life on a postcard. Your life is there. Well done. Thank you for that, Jonathan. That's amazing.
You're welcome.
That's really lovely.
One more quick one of mine now, without any of the emotional burden of that one. This is Ilfracombe. Ilfracombe in Devon. And it's a little view of the harbour. This is from 1967, so a while ago now, 1967, 24th of August, since you ask. And it says, don't forget, this is from Mum, by the way, and Mum says, hello, Sib. Sib, I think, is her daughter, Sybil, I suppose.
Sybil.
And it says, don't forget to tell Milkman to leave 4 pints Saturday morning, as always. I'm writing this in the Holiday Inn, listening to the organ. And very nice. Helps the meal along. So there you are. She's having a little organ playing while she had her lunch. I thought that was a rather nice image to imagine.
And she's, I wonder what they were playing. Some special digestive-related music.
Well, 1967, August, I think it could be psychedelic hits of the day, actually.
It could be The Doors or...
Yes, or White as Shade of Pale. That had a big organ part, didn't it?
Yes, or The Love and Spoonful.
Very good, very good.
I'm just going to stay completely out of this pun fest.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Podcasts from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. And my guests today are children's author Jonathan Mears and artist Liza Adamczewski. Now, a surprise, we've received a postcard. And the postcard we received is from Mrs. C. Wardle of Cromer in Norfolk. And the card is a picture of Cromer. And Mrs. Wardle says, I think the mystery voice is Carol Channing. Well, I'm afraid that's the wrong answer, Mrs. Wardle. On with the podcast. Liza, now, what's the second card you have for us? I think it's one of your own artworks.
It is, yeah. I'm sorry, I've got the giggles after that. That's so funny. Yes, it's one of my icons. I started doing while I was in lockdown, having sort of run my hashtag 1000 postcards project for nearly 2 years by the time we went into lockdown. I realised that I wasn't going to be seeing an awful lot of humans because our little cottage is in the middle of a valley and we own the valley and there are no public footpaths through it. And so we don't see anyone. And I have had some illness in the past, so I was shielding and not going anywhere at all. And once a week, the delivery truck would arrive with our food. And so I started to realise that the birds and beasts in my garden were becoming my cast of characters, shall we say, for friendship. And I was doing the washing up one day, and I've always had a real passion for bullfinches, but you never get to see them much. You know, you'll see the back end of one flitting over a hedge or something. They're very shy birds. And I think they're like the Ray Winston of the bird world. They're very chunky and quite gorgeous and tough looking.
They're stunning.
But when they open their mouths, they just go like that.
Absolutely.
Which is very weird, actually, because in the old days in Germany, woodcutters used to catch bullfinches and they'd spend the winter training them to sing all sorts of different songs.
Good Lord.
And then they would sell them for lots of money as caged birds. So actually, bullfinches can sing quite complicated tunes, but, you know, if left to their own devices, they just go, ew, like that. Anyway, so I was standing at the kitchen sink washing up, and some plants had gone a bit wild by the window and grown up very tall. And I didn't have the light on in the house, and I hadn't cleaned the windows because it was locked down and no one was going to come round anyway. And this bullfinch landed on one of the plants right next to the glass of the window, about, I don't know, 20 inches, 2 foot away from my nose. And I stood very, very still, and it just looked at me through the window. And it was just looking in the window, and I didn't move, so it didn't realise I was there. And it was just glorious seeing this bird. So I painted this postcard of that, and the whole icon thing started really in lockdown of, you know, there's a huge art history weight of stuff about using gold in paintings, you know, iconography, and if you look back through religion. And if, so, you know, first of all, if you paint something, it's like saying it's special because you're going to waste several days painting it. And then if you put gold on it, you're elevating it to another level. So I decided to the things that were really, really special would get their own gilded postcard. So this is 5x7 gilded postcard of one of my favourite birds, which is the bullfinch, looking at me through the kitchen window on a twig, as if to say, are you going to teach me a song then?
But there's this gold, and it's gold leaf, presumably?
Yes, pure gold, yeah.
It is beautiful. It really, and it does do exactly what you're saying. It sort of turns them into something where your appreciation of it is visible and physical. It's physical. There it is.
Yeah, you know, it's lifted up to. So in the past, people would have only done this for Jesus.
Quite.
And now I think actually we should do this for the things that we really, really care about. So in the exhibition with all the postcards, there are two cabinets that have these icons in them of the really rare or special things. So I've, in fact, they keep selling, which is a bit annoying, and I'm having to paint new ones. And so orchids, and we've got some very, very rare butterflies here. And I'm just about to do their icons for I think in May I've got a chance to show the postcards again, because I had an exhibition of them which opened just as lockdown, the second lockdown happened. So it was open for 2 weeks, and a 4 month exhibition, that was it, bang, closed, which was a bit of a shame really, because it was going quite well. But yeah, so I'm painting some more of those. And what's happened through lockdown, as and it's been jawed on about a lot, but you know, people have really connected with nature in a way that they haven't before. We've had skies where there have been no aeroplanes, and we've had no traffic on the road, so we can hear the birds singing, and suddenly people are slowing down and taking time and realizing that they're part of something bigger than just their job and their home.
But it's a stunning, I have to say, it's a stunning postcard, and it's a stunning bird. It's one of my, I've mentioned earlier, I've been a huge bird lover all my life, and I still get, except we live very close to a river, the Water of Leith, and we get glimpses of bullfinches down there. And you're right, you just generally get a very fleeting glimpse. And they're not very popular with fruit farmers, of course.
Well, we've got lots of fruit trees. And the thing is, you just have to have enough. You have to have enough for you.
Is there enough to go around?
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't be greedy and expect it all for you, you know.
But it's,
and
yeah,
also,
but it's funny,
if you have proper hedges full of blackthorn, which is full of bud for the birds, they're not going to be eating all your apple blossom, because they've got what they need. And the reason why they eat everybody's fruit buds is because they've cut all the hedges out.
Yeah, that's true. The way that the images are on my attachment here, on your bullfinch appears to be eyeing up the blossom, the apple blossom, in your other postcard.
Yes.
It is.
It's funny. Yeah, but it's funny you should say about the song of the bullfinch, because that's the two things you've. Yeah, it is. It's kind of a little bit pathetic and weedy, but compared to other finches, I mean, you think of the beautiful song, finch. The goldfinch, the greenfinch is a bit. It just, the greenfinch just goes.
Yeah, goldfinches are lovely. They tinkle.
Oh, it's a tinkle of goldfish. Mm. But the other thing being that this of course is the male and the slightly dowdier female. But they're incredibly monogamous, the bullfinches.
Yeah. Where,
you know, that you can absolutely guarantee that if you see, you know, where one is, you just there'll be a couple of branches away.
Well, they always come en famille, as we say.
Yeah.
So this chap, who is our resident bullfinch, he comes along with what I would describe as his more subtly dressed wife.
Yes. Understated.
Yeah, understated.
Sorry.
And demure she is.
Yes.
And they bring son with them. So
really?
We have a wall in front of a typical Welsh tiny little cottage with its little front wall, so the cattle can't get in the front garden, which we don't have cattle, but the wall is full of lizards.
Oh, wow.
And lots of plants growing out of it for the lizards to shelter from the birds so they don't get eaten. And the bullfinch comes with his wife and child, and they eat the seeds of the plants growing out of the front wall. So you can stand and watch them, and they'll sit on the gate as well. So we're very quiet here. We don't have any cats. And I've got a 17-year-old blind deaf poodle who I have to carry around. He's completely, you know, we can't put him to sleep because he's perfectly happy as long as, you know, he's glued. We call him the limpet. As long as he's glued to me, he's fine. Yeah. So he doesn't chase anything because he can't see anything. And so that as time has gone by, they've got all the creatures have become aware that they're quite safe. You know, no one's going to shoot them or go at them.
I'd just like to apologise to any female bullfinches listening. I didn't mean to. The female bullfinches are very, very beautiful birds in their own right. So I didn't mean to diss you by using the adjective dowdy. Please don't cancel me.
I think it's a bit late now, Jonathan. It's a little bit late.
You've blotted that copybook, mate.
By by any other standard, a female bullfinch is absolutely.
We'll have to get your spokesman on to do a clarification. That's normally the way these days.
Yes, I'm going to have to come to the garden gate and issue an official apology with my family.
Well, I have to say, I think what you've done with the gold is such a simple but clever idea, and the effect is stunning. It's really beautiful.
It's been incredibly popular. I have got a waiting list of commissions at the moment.
Brilliant.
Because everybody who loves their wildlife and things, you know, all these women get in touch and they say, oh, my husband really likes bullfinches, or he really likes this. I'm thinking of getting him one of your paintings for his birthday. Can I commission you? And so I'm constantly having to repaint. I mean, the number of bumblebees and goldfinches I've done is just this year. We have a bit of a joke about it, really. Although actually everyone I paint with great love and I really enjoy doing them. I've just done a couple of lichen and moss studies for somebody, and I'm doing a robin looking through someone's window at the moment in their wisteria. And it's all, you know, I try not to make it twee. It's, you know, I'm really not twee. But, people are loving them. And it's great because, you know, in the winter, when it's especially this winter, it was really cold and damp and dark. And you put these paintings in the corner of a dark room and they just glow at night. And it just gives you that, a bit like people have a little shrine, it just gives you that thing to focus on that's really beautiful and warm. And
well, that's brilliant. Look, you know, thank you for showing us that one, Lisa. And it also opens the door to people who want to look at your hashtag 1000 postcards project, which is really good. Now, Jonathan, you've got a final card for us, which I happen to know, because we have spoken, brings with it its own little surprises. So would you like to tell me about that, or tell our listeners about
that? I would. I'd love to. We go round the UK coast in a clockwise direction, or anti-clockwise. You'll still end up in the same place. I don't know, 200 or 300 miles southeast of Moora, the West Highlands. We come to Sutton-on-Sea.
Sutton-on-Sea,
on the Lincolnshire Riviera, the Costa del Skeggy, the Costa del Skegness, basically the North Sea coast between the Humber and the Wash. And this is another place that has a great personal significance for me. And I suspect a lot of other kids, a lot of other children of the East Midlands, growing up in the 60s, as I did, because it's where we spent a good many summer holidays. I've already mentioned, well, with the Nottingham and Melton Mowbray. I was basically born in Nottingham, but lived most of my childhood in the Vale of Beaver. That's the Nottinghamshire-Leicestershire borders, the little villages. That's how I ended up going to school in Melton Mowbray. But, you know, wherever you're from in the UK, you sort of tend to gravitate to your own bit of coast. People in Lancashire will go to Blackpool and Southport. And, you know, people in London will gravitate towards Kent or Brighton. Well, back in the day, in the 60s, foreign travel and the idea of foreign holidays, it wasn't completely unheard of, but it was, you know, it obviously wasn't all that common. And sure. For families like my own, who basically born and raised in the East Midlands, in Nottinghamshire, Leicestershire villages, the majority of people, when you thought of going away on holiday to the seaside for 2 weeks at the seaside, would tend to gravitate towards the Lincolnshire coast because it was the closest bit of coast. And in fact, being of a certain vintage, I can even one particular holiday, I can even remember arriving by train, Sutton-on-Sea station was actually, I think it was closed in 1970 because of the Beechey report and everything. But this is in about 1965, actually. One of my earliest memories, actually, of arriving with my mum and my brother and our suitcases in Sutton-on-Sea station. And the train was actually pulled by a steam locomotive. Not like the Harry Potter Jacobite train, not a restored, it wasn't a preservation line.
A regular
steam service. I think I probably went up and, if memory serves correct, these are the days when you go up and thank the driver. So I probably did go along and my mum would have said, go and thank the driver, Jonathan.
And lift your school cap up.
Yeah, exactly. Doffed my cap before replacing it in a suitably rakish angle. But yeah, so that's one of my earliest memories.
Amazing. As
going by Sutton-on-Sea, pulled by an actual regular steam locomotive.
Brilliant.
I think that was probably about 1965.
One of the last.
Yeah, it would have been. And I distinctly remember the following year, 1966, if you're keeping track of my increasingly rambly anecdotes, because I can vividly remember watching the World Cup final live from the lounge of the Bacchus Hotel, which still exists. And if ever there was an inappropriately named hotel, the Bacchus Hotel, the average age of Sutton-on-Sea residents was about 120 even back then. But I vividly remember this. Watching the World Cup final live from the residence lounge at the Bacchus Hotel. But the particular postcard that I have in front of me, and you'll see on your screens,
which we should describe for the listeners, I think.
Yes, okay, I'll describe it. It's a blue sky, a beach. Beach chalets, a long line of beach chalets with enormous sea defences because, I think, was it 1953? There were terrible, terrible floods in East Anglia and Holland and all around the North Sea. Many, many people lost their lives. There were terrible, debilitating floods. And subsequently, the sea defences were sort of fortified all the way along that stretch of coast. But in the foreground, you will see a bunch of donkeys and ponies. Yeah. I don't know if you even get this these days in seaside resorts, but certainly
some
back
I
then,
think some
you
I get, think
yeah horses and ponies and donkeys for children to have rides between the groins between the sea defences. And I am guessing that this picture was taken not in 1966. I am going to put my detective hat on, and I'm going to guess that this was taken the previous year, the year that I arrived by steam train. That would be 1965. And I'll tell you why I can guess that with a certain amount of accuracy, Lisa and Tom and anybody listening. If you focus in on the postcard, you will see right in the very centre of the postcard, there's a donkey's backside pointing towards us. You will see a small boy with knobbly knees, khaki shorts, and a red wind cheetah, brown hair, stroking a donkey's head.
Yeah.
And that little boy is me.
Wow.
Fantastic. That's you on the postcard.
That is me. Gosh, I wish I still had that mop of hair, I have to say.
That's amazing.
Is me. And if that donkey with its back, the donkey in the foreground with its backside to camera, if we could remove that particular donkey, you would see, I'm pretty sure, you would see me petting and stroking a donkey with a much darker coat, a kind of a chocolate brown coat. I can see him now. This beautiful donkey called Peter. He was my favourite. And the reason I'm in that postcard is that when we used to go for our fortnight holiday in Sutton-on-Sea, I would while away my time when I got bored with paddling in the maple leaf shaped paddling pool, which still exists, given to Sutton-on-Sea by the people of Canada. I think it was sort of donated to Sutton-on-Sea. It would have something to do with the proximity of the Air Force bases in the war. That's how my dad ended up living in Nottingham, because he was a fighter. He came over in the war when he was very, very young and ended up being a pilot in the RAF. And that's why I'm from the East Midlands, because of all the Air Force bases. But anyway, I would while away my time on holiday in the 60s. I was a huge animal lover, still am. And I would help Mr. Bucknell led the donkeys. If you go to the right hand side of the postcard, you will see a portly gentleman facing away with a dark coat and a cap. He was the guy who was kind of the guy that owned all the donkeys and the ponies. The guy on the far left in the sort of the cavalry twills, the chinos and the tweed jacket, are eyeing the photographer quite suspiciously. Yes. Who can blame him? I think he was his son. But anyway, I would.
He's got a stick, I think, hasn't he?
He has got a stick.
A prodding stick.
It looks like he's not afraid to use it either. But we would, myself and this other little group of kids, we would turn up at Mr. Bucknell's stables every morning, and we would feed the donkeys, get them prepared, put their saddles and their bridles on, and we'd lead them down to the beach, and I would spend all day long just walking from one of the groins, that's the right phrase, isn't it? The
breakwaters.
leading the donkeys up and down, and I was happy as Larry. And I was obviously very unaware that this photograph was being taken. And I think it was, obviously it's a very long time ago. Memory's a little bit hazy, but I am guessing that a couple of years later we would have been in Sutton-on-Sea, and there was a particular shop, a newsagent, the sort of newsagent at quintessential seaside resorts. You would get buckets and spades and the little flags and windmills and whatnot outside.
Yes.
And there would be, and you'll be familiar with this, Tom, like a carousel of postcards. Mm. And I would be I would be off, because we were feral. It was different times. my mum would be in the bar at the Bacchus Hotel at this point. And we were, myself and my brother, we'd be off. And I would have gone into this seaside paraphernalia shop, I don't care, and flicking through and looking at this postcard, because I don't think it was ever drawn to my attention. I'm pretty sure that a couple of years later, I would have just been idly looking at these postcards and thinking,
amazing.
Hang on, even then, thinking, hang on. And hence why I'm actually center foreground of this mid-1960s postcard.
And your brother's not in the picture?
My brother is not on the... There may be a reason for that, Lisa. If it was 1966, my brother and my father would have actually been in Poland. My mum and I watched. My mum and I were on holiday by ourselves that year. My father had only just been allowed to start going back to Poland.
Yes, yes.
After he left... Right. Basically, my dad... left Poland in February 1914. He wasn't even 14 years old, and he and my grandfather escaped across Europe. There's not a long, a heck of a story there. But basically, my grandfather ended up living in the States, and my father stayed, found his way to the UK, where he ended up being in the RAF and being in East Midlands Air Force bases, meeting my mum, hence me. But my dad wasn't allowed. My dad left his mum in February 1940 and didn't see her again for 20 years.
Mm.
21
me.
Years, by which time he'd got two boys. I was the youngest. I was just a baby when I went to Poland for the first time in the early 60s. But yeah, so from the time when my father was able to visit, the Iron Curtain and the whole restrictions lifting and everything, from the time when my father was allowed to,
your grandmother stayed in Poland, or
my grandmother stayed in Poland. My dad and my father escaped. No, sorry, my dad and my grandfather escaped from Poland because they lived in what is now part of the Ukraine. My dad was born in Lvov, and he lived in a place called Kosov and Przemysh near the border. And basically, it was like Russians from one side, Nazis from the other. Let's get out of here. They were seen as sort of being relatively sort of relatively intellectual, relatively bourgeois, relatively middle class. They escaped, leaving my grandmother with the two younger brothers in Poland. And my grandfather ended up in New Hampshire in the States, and my father ended up in the East Midlands. And he didn't see his own mum for over 20 years, by which time my brother and I had been born. Anyway, from that time, my dad sort of made up for lost time. And he was an amazing father, an amazing son. He would drive to Poland like twice a year. It was kind of a big deal then. It still is to drive to Poland. Mm. But anyway, that's a very long-winded way of saying it could possibly have been 1966. My brother was in Poland with my dad at that time. But I'm thinking it's younger. I look too young for 1966. But anyway, it was certainly the mid 60s. And
an image on a postcard like that can unlock a story like that?
Well, yeah.
That's a massive story.
And in fact, so many of these cards have people in them for a bit of interest, a bit of shape, and we will never know who those people were.
No.
Except this little boy petting the darker of the donkeys, half hidden by another donkey's backside.
Peter the donkey.
Amazing. Oh, I think that's fantastic. I'm so glad you've got it. I'm so glad that you've shared that with us, Jonathan. It's amazing. It's really, really fascinating.
It's been a pleasure to be able to share it with you, Tom.
Well, look, thank you very much, both of you. I've said it before on this programme. I never know where the cards will send us. And this time we've been to Camberwell, to Morar, to Sutton-on-Sea, to Pembrokeshire, to Edinburgh, to Ilfracombe, all over the place. Thank you for sharing them with me and with each other and with the podcast listeners. Another quick reminder for everyone at home, there'll be images of these cards, including a young boy petting Peter the donkey, and on postcardfromthepast.co.uk. And also, importantly, you'll be able to see Lisa's artwork, so you get a feel for what that's about. Now, before we let you both off the line, back to unzoom and unclean feed and take your headphones off, I've got one more postcard to look at. It's kind of a custom for us to end with one of these. So if you look at the last card on your information sheet,
got it.
You should be able to see a group of people, I think. Now, exactly. So I don't know, one of you could use your skill at description to explain to the listener what we're seeing. So what's the image?
It's an umpapa band of some kind. You've got a load of what looks like they could come from Bavaria or anywhere.
There's about 20 of them, aren't there? It's a lot of people.
Yeah, lots of women seated on the ground in sort of dirndls and men in kind of lederhosen with accordions and what looks like an auto harp.
I think it is something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, and they're all very pleased with themselves in a kind of slightly Aryan superior way, I think, really.
Yeah, well, I don't know about
the Pope. The Pope is there playing the auto harp.
You think that's
look,
the Pope?
Look, it's Pope John Paul II.
It does look a little bit like him, doesn't it? Oh, I was going to say, I don't have the best view of this, but is that not the Polish eagle? Or is it my? Should I have gone to Specsavers in Barnard Castle?
Playing up, so it looks like there's a wine stain on mine.
It could well be the, but the emblems on their tunics, is that not the Polish
eagle? Well, it's not. They're not Polish.
Okay.
So I think it might
Austrian?
Be a an Austrian
Bavarian
eagle. So, well, as you see, this is actually a postcard record, a record on a postcard.
Oh, that's the circle on it. I couldn't understand. I thought my printer had gone west.
Exactly.
Like a glass, somebody put a beer glass, a tankard.
Yeah.
In
so,
a beer keller card.
Back at Wardour Studios HQ, Tom has prepared a digital file of this. And if we listen very carefully, we should be able to hear what it sounds like.
Amazing.
This is my childhood. I spent so much. When I wasn't at the wool house, I was out in Bavaria at Schartner Hunting Lodge.
Ah. Well, this is actually Austrian.
Yes.
Ah.
And they're the Kitzbühler National Singers.
Wow.
Singing on a postcard.
With Bing Crosby on accordion on the right-hand side.
Yes. Well, I always say the same thing. That the quality is not bad for a piece of cardboard.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Wow.
Oh, bring them back.
I think someone might be bringing them back, actually. I have seen this reference to them.
I want,
but they were big
I
in the 60s.
To do those. Oh, I want to be able to make one of those.
Oh, the yodeling has started. Not bad.
I love the guy right in the very centre, where the hole in the record is. The guy in the very centre, he's got his hand kind of just cradling the hole. He's kind of...
Well, I think he's like trying to push the hole onto the other guy's face as a sort of practical joke.
Is there a potted plant in the middle of that trying to escape?
Somewhere,
yes.
Yeah, like a hydrangea or something.
Yeah. I think that hole in the middle is possibly a portal into another dimension.
Oh, God, that's just so awful. It's wonderful. That's really kitsch, isn't it?
Kitzbühel.
Well...
Look at the expressions on their faces. Wow.
As the Kitzbühler National Singers from Austria continue to rotate at exactly 45 revolutions per minute, that's it for this time on Podcast from the Past. I'd very much like to thank my first-class guests for sharing the postcards from their pasts, Lisa Adamczewski and Jonathan Mears. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Very welcome. Thank you for having us, Tom.
And thank you for listening. Bye for now. You can see more postcards with their messages posted every day on Twitter. Do follow me at Past Postcard. And you can buy the book, Postcard from the Past, by me, Tom Jackson, at Amazon and all good booksellers.
And if you're looking for podcast production, check out wardorstudios.co.uk.